Welcome to the Floor Specifier Podcast. I'm Brett Cyphers, your solo host and Government Affairs Director for Sea and Shoreline. I also host another Specifier Media podcast called Water for Fighting. Conspicuously absent is my co-host, Ryan Matthews, who is a big deal and government relations and policy expert with Gray Robinson. But he's missing for a very good reason today, because it would be weird to have him introduce a recording of himself. And that recording is actually really good. He participated in a panel of five of the last six secretaries of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection at the most recent Environmental Permitting Summer School, hosted by the current secretary, Alexis Lambert. Secretary Lambert interviews her predecessors about their experiences at the agency and the lessons they learned, and she even takes a few questions herself. I think you're really going to like this one, so let's get right to it.
My name is Frank Walker. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Florida Chamber, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all back to Marco Island for our 39th Environmental Permitting Summer School. It's been really great talking to a lot of folks about how this has become their family's annual pilgrimage, how they've been coming since they were children all the way up through being students and now instructors. So glad to see such incredible attendance at what's really becoming not just the premier environmental conference in Florida, but in the eastern United States. We've got an incredible panel. We're doing something a little bit different this year as opposed to just a singular keynote. We've got a trip down memory lane with some past luminaries in the environmental stewardship world. But I get to introduce their moderator and our current DEP Secretary, Alexis Lambert. So I was speaking with Alexis, who actually grew up with her and her family in Tallahassee, about this conference. And while this is her first keynote, this is not her first time in Marco. She actually told me that she remembers coming here with mom and dad and sisters, and hopefully the Lambert clan doesn't repeat some past loose interpretation of pool rules that sounds like it took place. But after being appointed as secretary by Governor DeSantis in November of last year, Alexis has really hit the ground running as secretary and is continuing the momentum from the gentleman that she'll be hopefully putting feet to fire up here on the panel of continuing Florida's legacy of being the most pro-environment, pro-growth state in the country. So before taking the helm at the Environmental Protection Agency, or department, Secretary Lambert was no stranger to state government. 20-plus years of service, ranging from Chief of Staff in the Office of Bond Finance, which funds a lot of the environmental restoration and conservation programs that so many of us work on year over year. She also served as the Chief of Staff for the Department of Health and the 15,000 employees that take care of Florida's ever-growing but also aging population. She had time at DCF, at DBPR, with the CFO, quiz her on all the different acronyms that she's had to learn over the years, leadership, communications roles. But more than anything, I think that Alexis also is going to be a steady hand at the wheel as we move into a very important time for Florida's future. If you see her out by the pool later on this week with her kids, they're probably in tow with mine, Georgia and Evelyn, running around. But we're just thrilled that she's here for her first time as secretary, even if not first time at Marco. So please join me in welcoming to the stage Secretary Alexis Lambert.
Thank you for the very kind introduction. This is a full circle moment for me. And I didn't picture myself up on this stage with these gentlemen, but what an honor it is. And I first want to just say that when we were talking about this conference months ago, Ryan and Jeff and Jamie said, oh, well, the secretary gives a keynote to about 1,000 people. I said, I'm not doing that. So we said, what are we going to do that's a little bit different? And I thought about taking on this role in the conversations that I had, you know, leading up to it in the beginning of my tenure. And some of the best conversations I had and advice I received was from the men on this stage. And I thought, why don't we show that to everybody and give them a glimpse of what those conversations looked like and talk about some hot topics that we did privately in a more public way. So I know everybody will be on their best behavior, but yeah, excited to share that conversation with you. And I'll moderate, but I also think you'll have an opportunity to ask me some questions and maybe get some insight about what we're doing at the department and where we're going at DEP. I would be remiss not to mention that we are missing a secretary. I think maybe the longest serving secretary, Noah, is not here, so we're going to make fun of him. Not really. We're going to miss his insights, but I wanted just to mention that obviously he's not here today, and we will miss him. So I'm going to jump in with a question for everybody, and if y'all will just pass the mic as we go down, but this is our opening question. How did you approach balancing timely permitting with strong environmental protections? How do you think permitting policies have evolved or should evolve to meet Florida's current and future environmental needs? Herschel, we'll start with you. We'll go in order.
Certainly. So I think there was really two things come to mind. One is follow the law. And the second one is what gets measured gets done. So let's talk about the measuring. Whether you're in business or government, you measure productivity. And if you're not measuring that, then you're not going to be productive. And so I would say that the measuring permit processing time is one of the most important things for the people out here. And what you're going to find out if you do that is you'll figure out which office might be dragging some, or which group or which employee might be not doing things as fast as you want them to do. Now, I will say permit processing time. I didn't say permit issuance, because the answer might be no. But for all the folks that I deal with, if the answer is no, tell me soon. Tell me now. Don't wait for a year before you say, oh, no, and I've just spent thousands and thousands of dollars and burned a year's worth of time. Second thing, follow the law. You know, the legislature, we've got some legislators here today. They spend a lot of time passing the laws, and then DEP spends a lot of time with their rulemakings, and all y'all participate in these rulemakings, or many of you do, in deciding, well, where is the line? Where are we going to, how are we going to protect the environment? And it's going to be clear in the rules. And so it shouldn't be that one reviewer maybe doesn't like somebody or doesn't like your project. The answer ought to be it's in the rules. So apply the law. Don't deviate from the law.
Thank you. John, anything to add to that? I agree completely.
I was going to say, man, why'd y'all let Vineyard go first? I guess it was an age before beauty.
You can just say ditto.
Age before beauty. But no, I won't say ditto, but I will say, you know, back when Vineyard and I were there, the running joke was you could roll by the copper top with your window down and we'd throw a permit in there. That was not true. You had to stop.
We won't be doing that now.
Yeah, you had to stop. But in all seriousness, we did provide people with timely answers so that they knew how to invest their capital. Whether or not they were going to get to a yes, and it wasn't always yes, it was a no, and we would tell them. We would be out in groups, and Governor Scott would point over and say, you see that guy right there? You can ask him a question. You're going to get an answer. You might not like the answer, but you're going to get one. And I will say, you know, and I'm not being critical, but it seemed to wane a little bit under COVID times, and I'm glad to see that that's improving. And Vineyard already stressed follow the law, and that's always follow rule, follow statute, and apply that. Don't apply your personal perspective. Don't apply your personal agenda. Meet the requirements of the law, and you don't have that problem. There's always innovation to be had. You know, how can permit changing? How can it improve? Innovation with technology, but first and foremost, you know, follow the law. It's hard to get that human factor out of it, but if you do it, you're going to be on the right side of things every single time.
I mean, really not much to add, quite frankly. I think the metrics that were put in place by the time I became interim secretary, and I say interim because I don't know if everybody saw, but my name was misspelled on the front slide, so I guess that's what you get for being interim secretary. But I would say that Vineyard and Steverson really kind of put in place the performance metrics of our permit times that really they showed the case, because one of my big frustrations prior to being in the department, and you know it's waned a little bit since leaving the department, is don't RAI somebody to death. The permit review process can take a very long time as it is, and I think we've all been a part of an instance where effectively the issuance and the review has been slow walked. And so I think a lot of the metrics that were put in place, again, held people accountable, where obviously if there is a request for additional information or some kind of communication needs to go back and forth from the department to the applicant, that's great. But at a certain point, that communication needs to be elevated, because if you're on your 15th meeting with somebody over a permit review, you're obviously wasting a lot of time. And I think Steverson and Vineyard said it appropriately. Sometimes the answer is no, and that's okay. But let's not take 3 years to get to no if no was going to be the answer in the first 3 months.
I think, obviously, all of these are my former bosses, and I'm last in this discussion. And as I sit here, there's not a single one of them accepted that no pleasingly when they became, I'm just saying, on the outside. So full disclosure, it sounds simple, but it's a fact, though. No should be guided, to Herschel's point, by the law. I think most as regulators, you want to stay solution-oriented. You want to work to yes, right? But in the same breath, you need to stand firm with that law if it does not provide it afford what that project is trying to do clearly, indefensibly, and make that decision early on. And I think you owe that to the applicant because of the investment. We've all talked a little bit about the backward side of this, looking backward, whatever. But you asked part two of that question, thinking about the future. I do want to acknowledge what's happening, and you think about the history, you think about, you know, growing additional rules, challenges, whether that's stormwater, BMAPs, all these things that are adding a layer of effort in the environmental permitting space, right? But largely out of necessity by water quality. So the question is, what are you doing to offset that process? What are you investing in ingenuity, regional projects, advanced septic systems? What are you doing to offset that capability? Because obviously we know environmentally the necessity is there. And so as we look to the future, as you talked about Florida's needs, I think there needs to be an equal deliberate focus on the ingenuity, the technology side, to make sure we keep that balance, because to your point, a viable economy cannot suffer without that ingenuity. So I just wanted to kind of look at it a little differently on part B of that question.
Really great insights, and I think y'all hit the nail on the head. Appreciate that. So Herschel, this one's for you. We're gonna talk a little about 404. So Florida's assumption of the federal 404 permitting program marked a major shift that spanned multiple administrations, beginning with wetland permitting streamlining efforts under your leadership, advancing to full assumption under NOAA and implementation under Sean, and unfortunately, ultimately, the rescinding of our authority. From your perspective, what were the key opportunities and challenges of that transition, and how has it shaped Florida's role in balancing environmental protection and permitting efficiency?
Sure. Well, 404 is my life. In the early 2012, 2013, we started looking at the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act, the very core of that is to have heavy state involvement. We don't think anything about having the state issue NPDES permits, so why not 404? At the time, Congress was interested, why aren't states being delegated authority? And so Jeff Littlejohn went to Washington, D.C. Congress had a hearing on it and testified. What we said was, look, Florida has probably the most sophisticated wetland regulatory system in the country. I think we are far surpassing every other state in amount of investment and focus on wetlands at any state in the country. And so why not Florida taking over the 404 permitting process for efficiency's sake? At that time, President Obama was in office. They weren't interested in delegating that program to the state. And so really, I think the opportunity where the stars aligned is you had the fantastic ability of DEP and Water Management District employees, and then you had a guy named Matt Leopold. I don't know if Matt's here in the audience today, but Matt was the general counsel at the time at EPA. His prior job was he's general counsel for Florida Department of Environmental Protection. So he had a front row seat in the capabilities of the state of Florida and the commitment of the state of Florida to wetlands. And I think Matt was really the key opportunity for that to happen. So what was that? Was the rest of your question?
I think you got it. Right. I think you got it. I'll add a little bit to that. I just want to share, you know, what we're doing at DEP to try to get the program back. Obviously, we're vigorously defending the assumption through the court system, through the appeals process, working closely with our members up in Washington and Congress to codify Florida's program and give other states the opportunity if they desire to take that on. And then I'm confident we will get it back. And so we have to be prepared at DEP when that happens, planning for hopefully some sort of glide path transition when that occurs. But as Herschel said, we have the knowledgeable staff to take on the program. And from an overarching policy perspective, I feel like those permitting decisions are best made closer to the projects. And that means Florida making those decisions. Steverson, during your time at the department, you concentrated heavily on Florida's water management districts. Why were those interagency relationships such a key focus of your tenure?
Thank you, Secretary. I think when you're in the role that you're in now, you realize what a monumental task lies in front of you, and you have to have really strong partners to accomplish everything, not just laid out there in statute, but the projects that are really going to make a difference in people's lives every day, both from a water quantity standpoint and from their natural system standpoint. And the water management districts are integral in that. They're kind of a government closest to the people role, if you will. You just mentioned making those decisions closer to, they're right there every day in their communities, and they're spending their ad valorem tax dollars on those types of projects. And so both of these, water quantity and natural systems, are just critical to Florida's ability to continue to flourish. And it takes the right folks in those roles to know how to balance all these interests that lie throughout the state. And we've got some great former DEPers in that role. I don't know if you're still here, but Lyle Sigler from Northwest Florida. If you're out there, please just wave so people can come find you throughout the conference. That's another great thing about this conference. You can meet these people one-on-one and spend some time with them. Brian Armstrong at Southwest Florida Water Management District. I know he was here a little bit earlier. And Drew Bartlett is not here yet from South Florida, but Jen, will you please wave? Jen Smith, she's the chief of staff there. She really runs the place anyway, so keeps everything great. So some good former DEPers, and then at some of the other districts, Mike, I see you back there from St. John's. He's been with the district since 1990. I bumped into Mike originally back in my days working for Governor Jeb Bush, and he's just a steady hand for that district and has always been a problem solver. And Hugh, I see you over there. If you'll wave, please. Swanee River. I mean, you couldn't have a better background for his district with his time in the Office of Ag Water Policy. And then I hate to have a piece of paper up here, but I wanted to read something because probably a lot of people don't know that Hugh has been inducted into the Southeast Region Conservation Hall of Fame. But the part that I wanted to read was a motto that Swanee has up on their website. And I think this is just applicable to all the districts and something that the department can get behind, too. The mission of the Swanee River Water Management District is to protect and manage water resources using science-based solutions to support natural system and the needs of the public. The district holds true to the belief of water for nature, water for people. And I just think that's spot on.
That was good. Thank you so much.
All right. So now a little question for you. I mentioned balancing a lot of different interests. Some people may say I didn't always do that great a job of that, but, you know, very first thing you asked me when I got up here is, am I going to behave? So I will. I'll leave that alone and move on. But I do want to ask you, you know, how do you plan in the position you're in? I mean, all the different interest groups that we have, all the myriad of issues that the department faces, and the way people just watch everything you're doing like a hawk, how do you plan to interact with all those stakeholders?
Well, I can promise I won't always get it right, like you said, but I think how we approach those issues stems a lot from how, you know, our personality types and how we manage. So I like to collaborate. So when I meet with people, I hope that you'll feel when we meet that I'm listening and trying to understand your perspective. And although we might not always agree on everything, the goal will always be to find something that we can agree on and push toward that goal. And as much as we can let the things that we're not agreeing on fall to the side, or tackle the thing that we can focus on and agree on first and then let the others kind of follow suit, that's how I like to solve problems. And I think that those relationships work when you're working with a trusted party who you feel like you can be open with. And I think that that's how we can reach solutions quickly, especially for hard problems. So I hope that you'll find that when you're working with DEP, and I know that the members of our leadership team desire that as well. Ryan, you advanced spring protection rules during your tenure, How do you view the strength and legacy of those rules given the ongoing legal challenges?
In flux,
yeah.
I guess.
That's an easy one, right?
How that legacy would be defined. I guess my first question would be, are there any First District Court of Appeal judges in the audience? Because that will likely measure how I respond to that. So Steverson actually brought me on to the department as the director of the Office of Water Policy. So he talked about water management districts, and my role in my initial job at DEP was the oversight and pseudo-supervisory role over those districts. But what I think Herschel started and John continued, especially with John's, you know, rural panhandle background, was a focus on not only water management districts, but springs. And so we started the effort of first working with the legislature, getting an established, you know, outstanding Florida springs designation, providing for additional protections because springs are lifeblood of communities. They really are not only a precious natural resource, they're an ecotourism opportunity, and they're one of the things that make Florida just unlike any other place, not only in this country, but in the world. And so we undertook, as your agency just finished, a number of basin management action plans to first identify where were some of these nutrient load allocations coming from, who was responsible for those, and then what do you do moving forward to clean up and make the springs back to both a historical flow, but also as pristine as possible. You know, that is painstaking work, and it takes a lot of stakeholders. Honestly, quite frankly, I think we've all been in this world and in state government enough to know that there rarely is something that is passed by administrative rule, by department final order, et cetera, that is not challenged. It's just the fact of the matter. If you have money, you can hire a lawyer, and I don't speak ill of them, I'm one myself, to challenge an agency action.
It's just hard to make everybody happy.
It is very hard to make everybody happy. And so at the time, we did exactly what we thought was right with the rules that were set out in front of us in order to ensure that there was springs protections. And so while legislation has evolved as it relates to BMAPs and your agency, again, 27 BMAPs were just adopted, you're not going to make everybody happy. And there will likely be challenges in those agency actions. But at the crux of it, it is how do we restore springs both to their natural flow and to their highest quality use as well? And I think at the end, you know, we'll end up prevailing. So I'm going to flip it on you. Obviously, springs protection, water quality issues are just a piece of the environmental puzzle. What do you see as potentially, you know, the most pressing environmental issue, or what keeps you up at night as it relates to environmental issues and protection in the state?
Okay, that's a good one. In terms of environmental challenges, this is not a new one. It's kind of a perennial thing in Florida, but I think it's getting more challenging. And it's just balancing environmental protection with growth. You know, we all know that growth and economic development is so important for our state, and it will continue to be. But with that growth comes an immense responsibility to protect the environment, because they are not mutually exclusive. It's inextricably linked. People come here because our state is beautiful, and we have, you know, unique ecosystems that you can't see anywhere else. But we understand how important our development community is to the state as well. So it's that balance and striking that right balance that I am always worried, are we right there in the middle where we need to be and not too far to either side? So I have worked at DCF though, so that doesn't, I don't know if it keeps me up at night. The other things at DCF kept me up at night, but I do worry about it. And I've said this to everybody I meet, but part of being the secretary that's hard is that people want to, sometimes they worry about coming to you with problems, and I don't ever see it that way. You know, I think if you're experiencing challenges, I'm not always going to know about it. So I want people to know that myself and our leadership team are available to you if you feel like we aren't meeting that middle mark. So an offer to the room, to the 1,000 people. So I'll probably regret that, but I do mean it. So thank you for the question, Ryan. Sean, you helped advance one of the most comprehensive updates to the state stormwater rules in over 40 years, another Herculean effort. Why was that such an important endeavor, and what balance did you seek in moving the rule through the process?
Wow, Herculean is right. And I think you got to go back and look at the backdrop, right? Because I think if you think about the balance, right, think about where the state has been and kind of where we are right now. You know, you've got obviously extensive water quality issues throughout the state, right? The backdrop is algae blooms, fish kills, you know, all those things that are very public and health facing. You start to see impacts to tourism. And I love the fact that you talked about balancing growth, right? The state's experience exponential growth, right? And you still want to see that to keep all the economy healthy and all that. So how do you find those opportunities to make sure you can sustain that? And we saw across all of the different sectors, whether it was agriculture, whether it was septic tanks, whether it was the opportunities in the BMAPs that you talked about, Ryan, all these different sectors had an opportunity to contribute to that solution. And stormwater was that, you know, that last big piece. And so obviously through the governor's executive order, through the legislator's mandate, through the Clean Water Waterways Act, you know, we were given a charge at the department to advance that rule set. And Candy, a lot of the folks on this stage and definitely a lot of folks in the room, they've had that, you know, they've been pushing and nudging. And we were just at that point where it was time to advance the rule portion, because I think advance is the right word, because we're not done yet, right? There's a lot of work to be done to make sure this rule is matured and ready to go. But if you think about it, think about sliding a piece of paper across the desk to a legislature, which we have a couple here. You know, I remember a couple of conversations with a certain legislature over there, and you slide across a $1.2 billion, regulatory cost across the table, and they're going to look at you very interesting, like, help me understand why that's within reason. And
you're a strong man.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not an easy thing to do.
It is not one to do, but when you look at the cost of all of the restoration and all of the things that require to go back to get those waterways back to their stated goal, it becomes reasonable and understandable and meaningful. So you start to invest in the policy. How do you make this turn this ship, right? And so there are a lot of policy folks here from the legislature, and I love the fact that they're here. They're hearing firsthand what goes into those discussions. And so the question becomes, how do you start to turn the ship, right? What is that reasonable term? What do you do to make sure that glide scope allows folks who's invested in projects and things of that nature to make sure that we're doing right by their investment, don't upset the economy, achieve? And so you saw the 18-month provisions to allow the glide scope. You saw certain carve-outs for investments and things of this nature in the projects. And so it's that right balance of achieving that role. And so, again, at the end of the day, it's really all about a lot of folks in here who did all the hard work on the rule. I was told never to mention names, so I won't mention names, John Coates. But there are a lot of folks in here on John Coates' team and him personally who are really the heroes with that rule. And they're the ones that should be definitely acknowledged for all of their hard work. And so, again, it's a journey that continues, but glad to have been a part of it. I read your Q&A, and if you haven't read her Q&A in the specifier, please pick it up. A shameless plug, because it is great, and I think it gives a good personal glimpse. But in there, you talked about the diversity of the mission and the environment here. And so as you had a chance to kind of wrap your hands, is there a particular aspect of that mission or that diversity that really excites you, that you're really passionate about?
That's like asking to pick my favorite child or something. But so I'm not going to answer that question as directly, because I think it's, I can find interest in all of it. I mean, it's part of why I decided to take the job. I mean, this is, it's just an honor to be able to touch so much that impacts everyday Floridians' lives, and that's the joy of the job. One thing I would like us to tackle, though, is a technology, something related to technology, which is going to be, if my husband was here, he's like, she's talking about technology, she barely knows how to use her phone. But I really want to find a way to use AI and power automation in our permitting processes. We have some of the most brilliant people who work at DEP, and I want them to be focused on their areas of expertise. And let's let the technology do the easy stuff, the checkbox, the did you fill it out all the way, you know, dumping information that's in a permit into a spreadsheet so it can be analyzed, that kind of stuff. Is it ever going to take the place of, you know, human decision? No, it won't, and it shouldn't, and there's got to be a lot of training around it. But I think that efficiency is the next step that we have to take. And if we don't take it ourselves, I think it's going to be, you know, forced on us, rightfully so. So we need to do some work internally on how do we implement that in a way that works for our staff and our clients, our users. And so I hope to be sharing those initiatives shortly. We're working on a policy internally to make sure we have guardrails, because it's going to be, guardrails will be needed. But I'm really excited about that. And I'm excited about the opportunity that it might give our staff to focus in on where their expertise lies. Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to wrap it up with one quick question for everybody, and then I will answer it myself. What do you hope your lasting impact was at DEP, and what lessons should I take from that? This says future leaders, but I'm here, so you're going to talk to me.
I just changed my answer just on the fly when you were talking about using AI for the permitting process. The challenge, the legacy that I had is prior to 2011, all the permit applications had to come in paper form. You had to submit 5 applications in paper. Y'all remember, I see the head nodding for those that have gray hair. But just think about it. 2011, wasn't that long ago, you had to submit it in paper. And I remember folks saying, oh, you can't do it electronically. And I said, we have old women selling quilts in the mountains and stuff on PayPal. And surely we can come up with a way to submit our applications electronically. And finally we did it. And now you're talking about AI. It's just fantastic to hear how it's moved from paper to AI.
That does seem very fast. I mean, 2011 doesn't feel like that long ago. But thank you for laying the groundwork for my initiative.
I tell you, I just leaned over and didn't realize we were so large up there on the screen. And that's a little spooky. So I guess one lasting impact could be I left all my hair at the department. But can someone zoom in and see Vineyard's multicolored crawdaddy britches here? He's taking resort wear to a whole new level. So that's certainly
he wins the style prize for sure.
A lasting impact. We got Captain Steuben with no socks on. But look, I learned so much from that man my time at DEP. And I think the best, most far-reaching lasting impact that you can leave as a leader of that agency is the people. And I mentioned some of that earlier when we talked about different people at different water management districts, but you know, it's you can be most impactful putting the right people in the right places and empowering them. And it, I won't say warms my heart, but it's very encouraging that day to day now in a different role, I call on those people all the time. Sometimes for work, but I like to call and just check in with them, and it's always welcoming to know that they're there and they're doing the right thing. And any advice I would give to anybody who's going to fill this chair later is remember that it's not about you. It's about those people. It's about those people at the agency. And always remember that you work for the people of the state of Florida, and they deserve to hear from you, and they deserve a timely response from you.
Well, clearly we should have coordinated because that was my answer. So thank you. I appreciate that. But it's true. I mean, quite frankly, you know, it's been 9 years since I left the department, and a vast majority of the people who were in leadership positions, either at the districts, at the water management districts, or at DEP, are still there. And so the community of folks who work at DEP are unparalleled. I mean, we are a state of 23 million people. We are a peninsula state who, you know, has a plethora of water yet struggles with water simultaneously. The decisions that are made at the department are really unmatched with any other state Department of Environmental Protection. And obviously, that's a biased opinion, but the people are so important to the day-to-day action of the agency. So empowering those folks to make the decision. And then from a leadership role, I mean, quite frankly, you know, I was interim secretary at 35. I was very aware that I was not the smartest person in every room that I walked into. You were not going to be able to have decades worth of experience in air and water and waste just because, you know, you assume a leadership role or you've got an educational background, again, without being, you know, ingrained in a certain subject matter. It's okay to not know everything. And so I think you've already done an excellent job at making yourself available to the people who are experts in ensuring that every fact pattern and every facet of a situation is heard and listened to. And then you make an informed decision based on the law and the protection of the natural resource. So I would say I would agree with Stevenson begrudgingly that it's empowering people.
Begrudgingly, wow. So John, I don't know what you did to deserve that, but you try being last on this panel, right? You know, considering that I had a chance to work for all of you guys. And like with anything in leadership, you grab pieces, right, that you believe to be effective, and you try to fashion your leadership style after those. And in some cases, there are things that you may not feel like that doesn't compliment me. Like I would have never worn those pants, you know. You know, and you know, so I just didn't factor that into my leadership style, right? But that's Herschel, right? That's what makes Herschel Herschel. But I think a couple different things, right? Just from the simple fact that, and again, I think you guys all exhibit that, you know, surround yourself with a good team, get out of the way, give them the resources, give them the vision, give them the understanding of the policy, and let them do great work. It's an amazing team at the agency. And then, you know, acknowledge their great work. The only time you should use I is when somehow you fail to achieve policy or you didn't give them the direction or reason. That's the only time I should factor in any of those conversations, right? And then I think for me, and again, just from a unique perspective, I think obviously being at the agency for 17 plus 18 years, ES0, right? You know, seeing like Herschel coming to visit and just being in total awe, like, oh man, how do you become secretary? What is that? You like God, it's got to be a gift from God. It's the only way that happens, right? And then, you know, staying true to your personal values, staying true to the agency's values, going in and serving the public, like John said, day in and day out, then great things happen. And so I think to my message to those who are called on public service, if you hold true to those, hey, the possibilities are endless. And so again, just a different perspective from somebody who has 18 wonderful years that I wouldn't trade for the world. So,
well, I don't have anything to add to that, because those were all perfect answers, and I couldn't agree more with the people aspect of the work, both the people we serve and the people who work at DEP. It's a people job, and ultimately we're empowering the people who work with us and serving those who call upon our agency. So I so appreciate all of you agreeing to do this with me today, and appreciate all of you for sitting around and listening. Thank you.
Well, that's it. What a great job done by Alexis, her guests, and yes, that includes even Ryan. If you want to hear more great conversations like this when they happen, then go to Marco next July. Registration opens today, actually, so don't miss out. If you like what you heard, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen, and don't forget to leave that 5-star rating and a review. If you don't like what you hear, well, obviously today it's Ryan's fault, so do be sure to let him know. But don't hold it against the rest of us. I recommend subscribing to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com and read your environmental news and commentary the new old-fashioned way. But do be sure to subscribe. It's easy, inexpensive, and offers a ton of ways to read, watch, listen, and learn right at your fingertips. Your support is, as always, greatly appreciated. Production of this podcast is by Carl Sorn, David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. And we want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. For Ryan Matthews, I'm Brett Cyphers, and we'll see you next time.